Miss Taco, I want to say shout out to all the raccoons on campus. You're listening to CGSF 90.1 FM on Burnaby.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Coming up, a nasty question. Could the closure of the Strait of Hormuz help save us from hellish climate change? At least 20% of the world's oil and gas has been shut down. What does it mean? Fertilizer, refined gas, propane, and diesel too. The awful bright side of this crazy war, or is it? Then two scientists with unseen stories of climate change, from Greenland to global sea life. But who can focus on anything with explosions all around us? Not just cities and oil tankers. Long-held institutions are crashing up pretty well in every country. There is so much sadness and trauma around. I have to play this little song.
What if I just blow up the world?
Black rain fell. I was tending to my children when they turned into night. Living wounded, dying, laid on the road in the fright.
You can download that piece, What If I Blow Up the World, and a couple of new tunes that are coming up in this show. Find them in the weekly Radio EcoShock blog, published Wednesdays at ecoshock.org. All free, of course. As you hear in this week's music, I am torn up by the crazy human suffering buried in the headlines. Little kids are huddled in basements. Families are strewn out over the pavements as refugees. There are explosions all around. Dreams of living are shattered by the insanity of a few leaders, their cultish followers, and military men. Meanwhile, this year's Arctic sea ice is set for another record low. Unseasonal heat appears around the world. If the forecast of an El Niño event is correct, it is only going to get hotter by the end of this year. The last El Niño in 2023 was a burner, breaking heat records, burning out lives, burning down forests. 2023 was a heat step that never went fully down again with this past year's La Niña. Each time, El Niño rides our nonstop emissions pushing further up the line to climate hell.
Is it a good thing?
Knowing the climate emergency is here and real, we can ask, is losing Gulf oil and gas a good thing for the climate and, in the long run, our civilization? Climate activists, all the worried people, see a rapid drop in fossil fuel burning as a prerequisite to saving a livable climate. This may be it. For an unknown amount of time, roughly 20% less oil and gas is available for the world to burn. In this view, the longer the Strait of Hormuz remains closed, the better our chances. Emissions from burning many millions of barrels of oil and gas do not happen. That strengthens the push for alternative energy and electrification. Bad-mouthed green development gets translated into a pressing national security issue, and we can all see it. There is a private ferry connecting an island in the Philippines to the mainland. It's tropical, there are fruits and flowers, and like many in the developing world, this ferry is privately owned. It is a hub in the local economy, essential to the lives of many poor people. Now the ferry is not running. Fuel is just too expensive, and the owner can't raise ticket prices for people already living at the edge. As always, the poor in America and around the world suffer first in these emergencies. The rich will pay anything for gas. People without the means do without a lot, like using a car, eating meals, heating or cooling, electricity, jobs, holidays. This means deep cuts for millions of people. Nobody is cheering this unplanned excursion into an energy shutdown. Just a couple of decades ago, professors and peak oil activists called for a planned descent, organizing group withdrawal from our addiction to fossil fuels. It was to be humane, and maybe it could deliver new benefits of enjoyment in our lives. That was turned away by something, profits, habits, who knows. Now we have the worst case, a sudden shutoff leading to earthquakes in the economy and possibly the fall of governments. The Greens never wanted to cut greenhouse gas emissions with a senseless war. But here we are. Can it work? In theory, a sudden 20% drop in available fossil fuels might seem like a win for the atmosphere. But as of March 2026, real-world data suggests that the Iran war shock could actually lead to a net increase in certain types of greenhouse gas emissions in the short term. The impact is driven by a phenomenon called fuel switching. The world's energy system scrambled to replace clean-burning gas with dirtier alternatives, like coal. The biggest climate risk right now is the loss of Qatari and Emirati liquefied natural gas, in some people's views. Countries like China, India, and Vietnam spent the last decade moving away from coal towards natural gas to reduce smog and carbon. With LNG prices up over 75% this month so far, and supply physically blocked by the Strait of Hormuz, these nations are being forced to restart aging coal-fired power plants to keep the lights on. Because coal is roughly twice as carbon-intensive as natural gas, burning coal to fill the gas gap can increase total emissions to rise, even if total energy consumption falls slightly. Also, as covered in last week's Radio EcoShock show, this is a war against the atmosphere. All the military jet fuel burned, the missiles, the Navy ship fuel, the logistics, it adds up to significant emissions that replace some of those hoped-for reductions from oil and gas faltering. Plus, as countries bomb oil refineries, storage tanks, and pipelines, fossil fuel emissions leak out into the atmosphere, likely for long periods after the war ends. There are other problems with the supposed wartime emissions cut. For example, ships are being diverted around Africa the long way, adding 10 to 14 days burning heavy fuel oil for every voyage. Other countries restart their oldest, least efficient refineries at maximum capacity to compensate for the loss of refined products. It is so complex. We may only know whether this war actually helped reduce greenhouse gas emissions or not, from what they would have been anyway, in a few years' time, when all the data comes in. I often wondered, even aloud in my blog, whether climate disruption will be so severe that some countries bomb coal mines and oil wells in a desperate bid to control emissions. And here we are. I would not want to count on climate benefits from the blockade of the Gulf or any other part of this strategic blunder. War is not the answer to anything.
Admire Tony in the mop, Nice country you've got there. Shame if something happens, dropping from the sky. In a time when bad guys win, we profit from the lie. Pesky journalists, nobody needs them, no. Minds need not apply. Oh no, get off the hit list, get on the thrift list, learn how to profit from the lie. Got a man cave full of games and cars, got a walk-through closet with gowns made for the stars, got a house in Portugal, a town home, a free pass from the law, a wall, a gun, a wet bar. My golden running shoes, my golden ballroom, gilded bathrooms, penthouse in the sky. Got it all, got it all, got it all. It's the profit of the lie. I got
Radio EcoShock.
If living things in the ocean are killed or damaged by rapid changes in ocean temperatures, we are all in big trouble. Ocean life provides oxygen that we breathe. The fisheries from there, they provide key food for billions of people. And amazing life in a billion forms in the sea, they have their own rights to keep living without our permission, our interference, or our needs. What will happen to fish as oceans heat up? Can we assume bad news? We have answers in a new paper. Long-term warming reduces fish biomass, but heat waves shift it. We reached out to the lead author, Dr. Shahar Chaikin, with a PhD in marine ecology. Shahar is currently a postdoctoral fellow with the Department of Biogeography and Global Change at the National Museum of Natural Sciences in Spain. From Madrid, Shahar Chaikin, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you very much for having me.
What got you interested in the future of fish in a warming world?
Well, that's a good question. I'm originally from Israel, which is in the east part of the Mediterranean Sea, which can be considered as a global hotspot for climate change. So as I grew up, I've seen the sea that I really like getting warmer and warmer over time. And not only that it gets very warmer and a hotspot for climate change, it's also a big hotspot for biological invasion since the opening of the Suez Canal that connects the Red Sea with the Mediterranean Sea. So this created a lot of change as I grew up under the sea. I've seen new species arriving, other species becoming less common. So being concerned about and interested about how climate change and global change in general is changing our ecosystems is fascinating me. And that is the main drive, I think, that curious me.
Back in 2003, marine ecologists like Boris Worm in Nova Scotia predicted rapid worldwide depletion of predatory fish communities. But the main concern then was industrial fishing, cleaning out the stocks, as happened to the East Coast cod fishery. Is it fair to say your new work doesn't really count overfishing or ocean acidification or pollution? You're just looking at changes in ocean heat?
So I wish to start by saying that, first of all, I don't downplay the effects of fisheries. Overfishing is a massive threat to the global marine biomass. It is true that our models focus specifically on the climate signal, the long-term warming and marine heat waves, and we did not isolate the impact of commercial fishing. However, we can be certain that the distinct patterns we found are not the result of fishing. So in our work, we found that fish populations located in the warm edge of their range are actually declining in biomass when a marine heat wave arrives. While on the other hand, cold edge populations, those in the cold edge of the range of the species, are actually increased when a marine heat wave arrives. So there are different responses. So if these massive swings in biomass that we observed were just from fisheries, we would have to assume that fishers are magically coordinating to overfish specifically during marine heat waves and only targeting the warm edges of species habitat while ignoring the cold edges. That's obviously, it makes no sense. So further, that this distinct cold edge winners and warm edge losers pattern that we see is a clear climate fingerprint. And on top of that, regions that are warming faster are actually showing greater biomass loss. And we're not the first study to connect warmer oceans with biomass declines. So because fishing inherently removes fish, the true declines that we see are likely even worse than our climate-only estimates. This is what I can say about the effects of fishing within this context.
So how much is the global ocean warming every decade, and is that rate itself changing?
So to answer that accurately, we really have to look at it in two steps, I believe. There's the global picture and the subset that we capture in our study that we report. So first, looking globally at the ocean surface, the rate is accelerating dramatically. A recent study in 2025 by Merchant and his colleagues showed that over the last 40 years, the global sea surface warmed by an average of about 0.13 degrees Celsius per decade. However, because Earth's growing energy imbalance, that rate is essentially four times faster than several decades ago. It rose from 0.06 degrees per decade in the late 1980s to a staggering 0.27 degrees per decade over the last 5 years. So the global surface heating is indeed accelerating. In our study, we focus specifically on the seabed across major northern hemisphere basins where we had biological data. So it's a subset of the northern hemisphere. We're talking about the North Atlantic, the Northeast Pacific, and the Mediterranean Sea, because that is the actual daily environment for those bottom-dwelling fish. So we focus on the seabed. And at the seabed level, we found that 93% of the areas we examined are experiencing decadal warming. The average rate was about 0.06 degrees Celsius per decade at the seabed. However, the ocean does not heat evenly, and we found some extreme regional hotspots warming at rates approaching 0.4 degrees per decade. And what our paper proves is that even these seemingly small fractions of degree at the bottom of the ocean translate to big losses in fish biomass.
I think that's amazing that not only is the sea surface temperature heating up rapidly, but the seabed itself is also getting hotter. How is that data collected? How do we know what's happening at the seabed?
Yeah, regarding the seabed, let me just do here a tiny correction. We're not talking about the temperature of the seabed. We're talking about the water temperature near the seabed. And in order to estimate that, we actually used available data from the Copernicus Marine Service that has a global ocean physics reanalysis models that are available to use. So what basically these models are doing, they're taking in situ observation, historical observation over decades. Using the supercomputers and models, they allow us to interpolate what will be the temperature in every day and in every place in the globe in a very fine resolution. So we're talking about today we can use resolution about 9 kilometers approximately. We use this data alongside the biological data to predict how fish biomass responds to warming and to estimate the marine heat waves.
Would you tell us about warm edge and cold edge as studied in your paper?
Okay, so I think we can do here a small analogy. Let's imagine a species' entire distribution is like a multi-story house. The warm edge would be for individuals in the sun-baked attic. These would be fish populations near the equator side of the species range, near the tropics, the warm edge. On the other hand, the cold edge would be for populations in the cool basement. These will be fish populations, usually the forward edge of their range. So when a heat wave arrives, you can assume that each population will be impacted differently. This is why we see diverging impacts of marine heat waves depending on the edge of the species range. Where a fish sits on that thermal position spectrum dictates how it will respond to a sudden heat wave.
Now, to be honest, I found your paper confusing at times. Of course, I'm not a scientist, but for example, take this quote. Using population level estimates modeled across extensive regions of the Northern Hemisphere, we found clear evidence that warmer years are associated with notable increases in fish biomass, while cooler years are linked to declines. Now, reading that, I would think, well, global warming is good for fish then. But that's not really what you're saying.
Yes, so this is one of the key points in our paper. So on average, we show that warmer years result in more biomass. But this effect, positive effect, depends on the thermal position of the population. In other words, this biomass spike in warmer years is driven by cold edge populations that gain in biomass. However, populations positioned in the warm edge of the range are actually losing their biomass. So importantly, if you compare a year warmer by 2 degrees Celsius against a year that is colder by 2 degrees Celsius, you will find that cold edge populations gain about 50% more biomass in warmer years than a warm edge population will gain in a cold year. So there is some asymmetry here, meaning that in general, cold edge population capitalize better in a warming world than warm edge populations will capitalize in cold years.
And the numbers also show huge swings of fish populations as waters heat up or cool down. An increase of 176% is quite large, and a decline of 41% is big too. Is that swing of populations with temperature, is it natural, or could that also be climate-induced instability?
Based on our models, these patterns tightly follow seabed temperature. Thus, I can say that it is part of the impact of climate change is inflicting on our oceans. Yeah, so I would say it's indeed climate-induced instability.
In addition to relatively slow general warming, we see more extreme marine heat waves. According to a 2020 study, the infamous hot blob in the North Pacific, that was in 2015-2016, it killed about 70% of Pacific cod in the Gulf of Alaska. Are marine heat waves always bad for fish, or could the hotter waters be good for some?
So according to our findings, we will say that it depends on what is your focal population. The blob marine heat wave that heated also the Gulf of Alaska is actually the perfect example of how devastating these events can be, but it only tells half of the story. So that 2020 study you mentioned found that 71% decline in Pacific cod was caused by a negative combination, the extreme heat that caused the cod metabolic demands to rise and simultaneously reducing their prey supply. The fish apparently starved. That is a scenario that can explain what may happen when a marine heat wave hits a population that is already near its thermal limit, what we call the warm ash of the species range. So to answer your question, no, marine heat waves are not universally bad in the short term. It entirely depends on where the fish are living. While populations at the warm edge collapse, populations located at the cold edge of their species range experience the opposite. So for them, a marine heat wave can create optimal temporary growth conditions, and we see their biomass actually boom by up to 176%. So marine heat waves can be good for some fish in the short term, but the warning from our paper is that the warning is that we cannot let those localized cold edge increases trick us. Those gains are transient. In the long run, what we show is that the chronic warming of the ocean is predicted to impact most of the species, driving biomass down in large parts of the northern hemisphere. So even if we do get those biomass gains in the cold edge, we should be very careful and track them as they may be transient.
Here on the West Coast, people marvel when tropical fish show up in our normally cold waters. I know you have some new work out on this waiting for review, but are these exotic fish arriving due to marine heat waves, or is it due to chronic warming?
So this question actually touches on some exciting new work we have. We took advantage of one of the largest accidental anthropogenic experiments, which is the opening of the Suez Canal in 1869, a bit more than 150 years ago, where humans played God, and we reversed about 14 million years of geology. We connected the tropical Red Sea with the temperate Mediterranean. Without giving too much away, we are finding that while heat waves might cause temporary visits of alien species that expand their range, it is the slow, chronic, long-term warming that actually explains most of the variability in colonization probability. And so this rising baseline allows tropical fish to permanently colonize the historically colder waters. But yes, this work is still under review, and these are initial findings that I can share.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
Why do fisheries decline over long-term warming? What are the mechanics of the slow death that might be expected with global warming? And do you think there could be possible tipping points ahead?
So first, I'd love to be transparent here. I'm an ecologist and not a physiologist. So our study was explicitly designed to measure the what, not necessarily the why, the mechanism. We quantified the empirical patterns of biomass change across numerous populations, but elucidating the precise mechanisms driving these diverging responses between short and long-term warming remains a key knowledge gap that warrants further investigation. However, we do suggest a few potential mechanisms that worth exploring and can explain this long-term decline. One of them is ocean stratification that may cause starvation. There's a sustained background warming drives those indirect effects. it intensified ocean stratification, meaning that the warm surface layers and cooler deep layers stop mixing properly. It reduces the vertical nutrient mixing from the depth, which limits primary productivity. Consequently, it lowers food availability at the base of the food web and continuously limiting population growth and essentially starving the ecosystem bottom up.